Welcome to the Trinity Forum Conversations podcast. In today's episode, we'll talk with Michael Ware about his new book, The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. He'll discuss what it would look like for Christians to be a countercultural force in an era of polarization and division.
We need to retrieve a sense that we live in a moral universe in which moral decisions are not optional. We make moral decisions all of the time. And our politics is actually not absent of moral assertion. You could say our politics today is actually more robustly full of moral assertions than it has been at any other time this century.
Today's episode is an edited version of our online conversation from January of this year. You can find the full video of that conversation with transcript, as well as our full catalog of event videos on our website, ttf.org. And check out the show notes on this episode for links to further resources. Here's Cherie Harder.
We are at the beginning of what seems sure to be a frustrating, fractious, even frightening election year. We've seen our divisions deepen, political rhetoric grow more extreme and debasing, and a sense of partisan identity intensify and the threats of political violence increase. It's an environment that often produces a sort of political fight or flight response, where some of us just hope to leave the scene entirely for our own protection, and others more motivated to fight fire with fire or give as good as you got and escalate policy disagreements into titanic battles of good versus evil. Even more sobering than these dynamics is that rather than serving as a bulwark or an antidote to these deforming pressures, many of our churches and faith communities have instead themselves been besieged or bewildered. A recent Barna study found that nearly 40% of pastors surveyed in the last year said they had seriously considered leaving the pastorate, and political pressures within the church was one of the primary reasons for doing so. I'm sure almost all of us can think of friendships or families, communities, churches, even entire denominations, torn apart over political disagreements or cultural clashes and our inability to deal with them well. Our guest today has argued that the toxicity of our politics is due, in his words, not so much that there are broad swaths of committed Christians who make exceptionally bad contributions to our politics, but rather that there is nothing exceptional about their politics at all. Christians have become part of the problem not because of what our faith requires, but in spite of it. Rather than transforming a diseased political environment, we have ourselves become infected by it. And in thinking how to best respond to the situation in front of us, he draws heavily from the late and great philosopher Dallas Willard, who I'm proud to say was a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum, the author of many books on both spiritual formation and philosophy, in which Dallas explores what moral knowledge in our time means. And drawing on that work, Michael Ware helps apply Dallas Willard's thoughts about moral knowledge to our own political environment, and to explore what spiritual formation might mean for the reformation of our politics. It's a hopeful as well as challenging argument, and I'm so glad to welcome our guest today, who does a brilliant job of making it, Michael Ware. Michael is the founder and CEO of the Center for Christianity in Public Life, a nonprofit that contends for the credibility of Christian resources in public life. He is also a senior fellow of the Trinity Forum. He previously served in the White House and on presidential campaigns, and as an advisor to a range of civic leaders on matters of faith and public life. He's also written extensively for publications including The Atlantic, The New York Times, Washington Post, Christianity Today, and many other publications, and is the author of Reclaiming Hope, as well as his brand new work released just this week, The Spirit of Our Politics, which we've invited him here today to discuss. Michael, welcome.
It's so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Great to talk with you. So as we start out, I always like to ask our guest about essentially the story behind the story. And Dallas Willard figures prominently throughout your work, The Spirit of Our Politics. And so I wanted to just to ask you, how did Dallas's thinking affect your own life? And how did it lead you to write what is largely an interpretation and application of much of his thought to a new realm, that of the political?
Yeah, Dallas changed my life. When I was a young staffer in the White House, I was sent a copy of The Divine Conspiracy, which I thought had a weird title. And it was by Dallas Willard, who I had never heard of before. And I thought, I don't have time to read this dense book from someone I'd never heard of before. But thankfully, my pastor back home in Buffalo, who rarely sort of wrote publicly, wrote a little blog post recommending this book. And so I thought, well, if I've been sent this book and my pastor is recommending it, I should pick it up. And I read that book, and it was like a second spiritual awakening in my life. And so personally, my family, we've made important decisions after and in response to Dallas's teachings from Jesus and from the gospel. Dallas thought that Jesus's gospel was about the present availability of the kingdom. He thought the Christian life was one of interactive relationship with Jesus in the here and now, that the gospel wasn't just for what happened after you die, but as he would say, eternity is in session now. And I think his perspective and many of the frameworks he uses, which we'll talk about today, are really helpful in repositioning our politics in a way that is not over the gospel, is not outside of the gospel, but is under and within, is a part of. And that is a vital move to make for society and for the life of the church in our lives as individuals. And so Dallas's ideas have so shaped me. And I think as folks look at this book, hopefully it will provide helpful paradigms for thinking about not just our politics, but our lives as Christians that touch on politics.
As you made a diagnosis of a kind of current political state in your book, yeah, I think you called our main problem one of sectarianism, yeah, and made the case that really our chief problem is not an amorality of politics, but a misplaced moralism, an anger that often attends it, or a distortion of it. Tell us a little bit more about that. What is the sectarianism that you believe we face? What are its characteristics, and how did we get there?
Yeah, so this certainly isn't the only problem in our politics, but my goodness, it touches so many of the problems that we have in our politics. This framework of political sectarianism was advanced by a range of social scientists in 2020. I find it to be a tremendously helpful way to think about the particular kind of polarization we have today. Importantly, the social scientists avoid and their framework is not about whether we're more polarized now than ever. I think sometimes that could be a trap and we get into pretty unproductive conversations. Instead, what they say is the particular kind of polarization we have today is, in their words, a toxic cocktail of three main ingredients. That's aversion, which is the tendency to dislike and distrust those who are politically different from you, who hold different political beliefs, the tendency to other those who have different political perspective than you, and then a misplaced moralization, as you referenced in your opening comments, this tendency to ultimatize political difference, to turn political difference into a pure matter of iniquity or sin or a purely good and evil. And this toxic cocktail has disastrous consequences for links to governance, for political dysfunction proper within the political system. It also is bleeding out into and is increasingly pervading our social lives, our families, our churches, these tendencies of aversion, othering and misplaced moralization. And so it's a helpful framework. It's one of the through lines of the book, not only part of the diagnosis, but a sort of object of the application. I believe Christian resources offer a tremendous deal to undermine these pillars, these ingredients of aversion, othering, and moralization.
Yeah, we want to dig into those. But before we do, I want to ask you a little bit more about that seepage into different spheres of public life. And coined a term, but really kind of riffed off a term of Christian Smith. Christian Smith is a sociologist who's well known for his scholarly work on something he calls moralistic therapeutic deism, which is sort of used to describe the widespread view, particularly among younger people when he did his research, of sort of having a view that there's a benign God who asks very little, but kind of exists to sort of, help me feel more healthy. And that's kind of the somewhat squishy, ill-defined kind of worldview that kind of guides their decision. You coined something called political therapeutic deism. And I wanted to ask you about that, in that it seems to speak at least a little bit to the seepage, in that it seems like you are essentially insinuating that people are going to church to get their political views affirmed while also seeking their identity, including even spiritual identity, in politics. What is going on and how did we get there?
Yeah, so I've said before that politics is causing spiritual harm in America. A big reason for that is people are going to politics to get their spiritual needs met. That's true, I believe. I think it's also true that people are going to vague notions of God, and there are varying sort of degrees of how opaque it gets, but people are drawing on religious terms, imagery, to affirm their politics, to sort of provide supplemental support for their political views. And political therapeutic deism is, I propose, it's characterized by a few kind of typical beliefs. So for instance, God is on my political party's side, or my views on political issues are a leading indicator that I am a true Christian, or I do not understand how other Christians could vote for my candidate's opponent. And so this is a framework, a tie between, again, more or less vague notions of God that actually are used to support one's political views. I also talk in that section in the book about, in a previous era, we saw, and this is still a theory, an approach, a seeker-sensitive church model. I argue that what we're now seeing is a politics-sensitive church model. Churches making decisions around attracting and not putting off potential or current congregants on the basis of political determinations. And these are all tied together.
In your work, you draw a connection between the kind of people that we are and the kind of politics that we have.
Yeah.
And on one hand, that seems indisputable. Of course, there's going to be a connection between who we are and what our politics looks like. But as I was thinking about it too, there were a few questions that came up, in that it seems hard to believe that our character as a people was vastly improved, say, 25 years ago, even though our politics was, and now it seems like a golden age, certainly more functional, more stable, and more civil. Which makes one thing, how much of our current predicament is truly our character and our character problems, or even our church problems, our religious problems, and how much is structural or technological? Obviously there's not an easy divide between all of those, but what else is going on here?
Yeah, so I think there are some other factors. I think I'm really clear. So the book is grounded in this idea, this conviction that the kind of people we are has much to do with the kind of politics and public life that we have. It's not a one-to-one translation. I mean, but part of what, when we understand that the representative ideal of democracy, and when we understand that the kind of people we are has much to do with the kind of politics we have, it actually forces us to look at some of our structures differently. It means that we look at something like voting rights as not just a structural issue, a legal issue, but something that actually interacts with the agency of citizens in really important ways. But I would say, I don't know how productive as sort of historic comparisons are. I would say that I do think it's quite plausible that that our politics now, for the issues that are grabbing folks' attention, both stem from and are not all that dissimilar from some of the political issues that were dominant 20, 25 years ago. I think actually some of the politics of the last 8 to 10 years, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book the way I did, it has very few references to current political controversies or current political figures. I think I've become concerned that the Christian discussion in particular has become so reactionary that we're missing some of the deeper trends and some of the deeper frameworks that helped actually contribute to this moment. And so I do think it's quite plausible that our character and the snowball effect of the, you know, David Campbell and Robert Putnam's American Grace didn't come out 5 years ago. They were warning about the conflation of what it meant to be a real Christian and a particular political ideology now over 15 years ago, I think. And so these things have a history, and what we're at now is just sort of where some of those trends have taken us. And it's not a great place, but also not completely without signals and warning signs that we should have heeded decades ago.
You know, obviously there are a lot of people who interpret some of our current difficulties as the rotten fruits of mixing faith and politics. And you take a very different approach and argument, even the name of your organization, the Center for Christianity and Public Life. And you argue that actually our faith offers incredible resources for a reformed and healthy and flourishing life together, of which politics is a part. Yeah. And in this work, one of the things that you talk the most about as being one of those resources is what Dallas Willard called moral knowledge, the reliability of moral knowledge. Tell us a little bit about what that is, how we know it, and how it applies to our current political predicament.
Yeah, so perhaps Willard's principal academic contribution is this idea of the disappearance of moral knowledge. By this, he's referring to roughly in the post-World War II era, what he calls gatekeepers of knowledge, principally academia, but also others, acted as if and made decisions as if religious or moral knowledge could not be considered publicly available knowledge. At best, perhaps it was of personal benefit and could be personally discerned, but it is not the thing, moral knowledge is not the thing that could be taught in public settings. You could not be graded for it. And I spend a great deal of time on unpacking this. I think it's a foundational sort of idea to understand how our politics, and importantly, how the Christian contribution to our politics has gotten to where it is. Importantly, I think this idea has a very different, sometimes when we talk in Christian circles about living in a post-Christian society or a negative world, and I think these concepts have some merit, but they tend to only reinforce a sort of us-them paradigm. They tend to communicate, if not in fact, at least by connotation, this idea that something has been imposed on Christians and on society. What Willard is very careful to lay out are all of the ways in which Christians themselves contributed to and have bought into the disappearance of moral knowledge. And so this is a concept, this is the second chapter in the book. What I argue and is that we need to retrieve a sense that we live in a moral universe in which moral decisions are not optional. We make moral decisions all of the time. And our politics is actually not absent of moral assertion. You could say our politics today is actually more robustly full of moral assertions than it has been at any other time this century. I think you've heard me say this before, Sheree. I think relativism is not the primary concern here. I think relativism is largely dead. We now have an age of moral assertion, but we have deep insecurity that our moral assertions have any authority. But when moral assertions become mere power plays as opposed to a representation of reality, then we get in a difficult place where almost anything can be justified.
Mm-hmm. You know, along those lines, one of the gifts that reliable moral knowledge gives us is that ways and means are vital as well as ends. I mean, this is something that Dallas talked a great deal about. This is something certainly that Jesus talked about.
Yes.
And, you know, and I actually remember kind of growing up being, you know, told that, you know, faith should not be adverbial. You know, and it should certainly be more than adverbial, but we also think it should not be less than adverbial either. And sort of how we go about what we're doing is actually sort of vitally important. And I wanted to ask you about this because one of the things that you argue for and discuss, which may seem, you know, almost unrealistic, is for a return of gentleness in politics. And you know, you worked in the White House. We were one of the youngest staffers during the Obama administration. You worked on a presidential campaign. I worked in the White House for someone from a different party. Politics has never been beanbagged. So, you know, as someone who's actually been, you know, in the midst of it, in the thick of it, where there's always incoming attacks, there's always elbows being thrown. What does that look like? You know, how does one embody gentleness in politics, as well as more broadly, an approach to politics that actually reflects He who we worship?
Yes. So this chapter draws on a book that Dallas wrote, The Allure of Gentleness. And this is Dallas's book about Christian apologetics. I read it as how Christians should act and behave in public. But Dallas thought that Christian apologetics had unfortunately developed into a series of tactics to insulate Christians and get the other side to shut up. It could often become a way of a tactic of not actually serving, but of defeating, of outcompeting. Instead, Dallas thought that Christians ought to engage in apologetics as an act of loving service. That's the exact term I use for what I think should ground Christians' political engagement. When we suggest that gentleness is not viable in politics or public life, that has embedded assumptions about what our responsibility is. And I actually think even more deeply, assumptions about what God needs in order to get what He needs to get done. And so much of this goes to our vision of God. And then our vision of God can inform our political engagement. So with gentleness in this chapter, I talk a great deal about anger and the esteem that we have for anger in our politics. This idea that if you aren't angry about something, you don't actually believe it. If that is what we think, then gentleness is impossible because anger carries with it the openness to harm. So we need to think carefully about our views of the world, what is necessary, and then think about how that applies to our political behavior. Gentleness is not an absence of conviction. It's also not a fear of confrontation. Let me say one more thing. There's a term in the book that I use from Eitan Hersh, who's a political scientist at Tufts, called political hobbyism. And political hobbyism refers to folks who basically approach politics as a form of entertainment, as consumers. And for the average Christian, you and I worked in politics. Maybe some on the call have worked in politics proper too. I get really concerned when people who don't have jobs in politics take on the dominant logic of political strategy in our politics today when they don't have responsibilities in that realm. And so I think there's a conversation for practitioners, and I think gentleness is possible for practitioners. I also just want to say to the mass of folks listening, relieve yourself of the burden of having to achieve the political outcome you desire in every conversation that you have, in every political action that you take. Your eye should be on something else primarily than the outcome, because the outcome is not in your control. And then that's something that you have to say to those of us who work in politics too. But yes, I'm so excited to hear from others the reaction to this chapter on gentleness, because it goes right to the heart of our assumptions about what is necessary in order to survive and thrive in God's world. And if we don't believe that the world is a perfectly safe place to live, so long as we're in the kingdom, then faithfulness is going to be very difficult.
You know, as you started to respond to that by saying that, you know, so often we hear like, if you're not angry, you must not care. We often hear like, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention.
Yes.
And yeah. Dallas Willard he offered so much insight on the spiritual disciplines. And of course, all the spiritual disciplines begin with, where do we place our attention? What yes. are we focused on? You know, in contrast to paying attention to that which makes us angry. I wanted to ask you about part of the last section of the book where you talk about the spiritual disciplines that can help form us for redemptive public engagement. And wanted to ask you to talk about what those are and what they look like.
Yes. So this book is written, as I believe Dallas wrote all of his books, with a particular model of spiritual formation in mind. He called it VIM, vision, intention, means. And so what you're referring to now is the means section. It's important that the means come after the vision and the intentions. And we've talked a bit about vision and intentions, at least implicitly in this conversation. When we're talking about spiritual disciplines, you know, there are several categories I talk about in the book. The first are sort of traditional spiritual disciplines and practices that I want to bring into contact with the particular kinds of public and cultural challenges that we have today. So for instance, I believe silence and solitude are absolutely essential disciplines given the particular challenges of this moment, increasingly pervasive political technology and media, the abundance of messages vying for our attention. Silence and solitude give us the opportunity to remember or maybe come to terms for the first time that we are more than an amalgamation of the various inputs and the various sort of statements about us that the world imposes on us. There's actually something innate about us as a person, as a human being with a soul. I talk about prayer, celebration, fellowship, service, what in spirit of the disciplines Dallas referred to as secrecy, I refer to it as anonymous service in the book, the study of scripture, of course. So these are all traditional spiritual disciplines that, depending on the challenges that people are facing when it comes to politics and our public life and the way that they're engaging, I think can be helpful. I also offer a number of sort of 21st century practices that are specifically sort of responsive to some of the challenges of the day. So I write about how Christians can approach news consumption. I write about how Christians can break groupthink within the context of their local community. And then finally, this idea of bearing one another's burdens and the political applications, the potential political applications of that. Importantly, and this is important, not just in this context, but just for folks' lives with Jesus, These practices are not meant to be a checklist of activity that you feel burdened by and that you feel like you need to do to be a super Christian. No, these practices are meant to be helpful in your walk with Jesus, that as you are taking off the old self with its practices and putting on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge of the image of its creator. And these practices have been found throughout time to be helpful as a way to invite the Holy Spirit and to participate with Jesus in that work that he's doing in your life.
Thank you, Michael. I'm going to ask you for a last word to close us out.
Yeah. Well, first, Trinity Forum is doing such a wonderful work, and Sheree, it's just such a joy to partner with you always, and would encourage folks to engage with the work that Trinity Forum is doing beyond this conversation if you haven't already. I would love for folks to read this book. There's a chapter in the book specifically addressed to pastors and parents who I think are facing unique and special burdens when it comes to faith, moral knowledge, formation, and our politics. And I've been so encouraged to hear already from pastors and parents who have been reading through this book. If you would like to read through The Spirit of Our Politics in community at the Center for Christianity and Public Life, we've created a free discussion guide that you can access at ccpubliclife.org, and I would love to have you engage with the book in that way. What I'd love to do is close with a prayer, and it's a prayer Dallas Willard wrote, his rendition of the Lord's Prayer that I just love and has meant a great deal to me. And so I'll close in that way. Dear Father, always near us, may your name be treasured and loved. May your rule be completed in us. May your will be done here on earth in just the way it is done in heaven. Give us today the things we need today, and forgive us our sins and impositions on you as we are forgiving all who in any way offend us. Please don't put us through trials, but deliver us from everything bad, because you are the one in charge, and you have all the power, and the glory too is all yours forever, which is just the way we want it. And Dallas would often end that prayer saying, whoopee. And so I'll say whoopee, and thank you for hosting this, Sheree. Always lovely to talk with you, and thanks to those who joined us.
Great to talk with you as well, Michael.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to subscribe to Trinity Forum Conversations podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're enjoying these, please leave us a review. Visit our website at ttf.org for more information and show notes from this episode, as well as resources such as our Trinity Forum readings and videos from our past events.